This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at ORFM Dunedin.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be with you in Arabic. My name is Arina Aizal and I'll be your host for the Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation today. In today's episode, we have an interview with Brother Irfan Arifin, a Singaporean who is in his final semester of health science at the University of Otago. We begin, though, with a recitation of the Quran by Sheikh Sa'ad Al-Ghamdi, Surah 10, Yunus, Jonah, verses 24 to 27.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. إنما مثل الحياة الدنيا كماء أنزلناه من السماء فاختلط به نبات الأرض مما يأكل الناس والأنعام حتى إذا أخذت الأرض زخرفها وزينت وظن أهلها أنهم قادرون عليها أتاها أمرنا ليلا أو نهارا فجعلناها حصيدا كأن لم تغن بالأمس كذلك نفصل الآيات لقوم يتفكرون والله يدعو إلى دار السلام ويهدي من يشاء إلى صراط مستقيم للذين أحسنوا الحسنى وزيادة ولا يرهق وجوههم قتر ولا ذلة أولئك أصحاب الجنة هم فيها خالدون والذين كسبوا السيئات جزاء سيئة بمثلها وترهقهم ذلة ما لهم من الله من عاصم كأنما أغشيت وجوههم قطعا من الليل مظلما أولئك أصحاب النار هم فيها خالدون.
Translation of the recited verses. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. The life of this world is like this. Rain that we send down from the sky is absorbed by the plants of the earth, from which humans and animals eat. But when the earth has taken on its finest appearance and adorns itself, and its people think they have power over it, then the fate we commanded comes to it, by night or by day, and we reduce it to stubble, as it had not flourished just the day before. This is the way we explain the revelations for those who reflect. But God invites everyone to the home of peace and guides whoever he will to a straight path. Those who did well will have the best reward and more besides. Neither darkness nor shame will cover their faces. These are the companions in paradise, and there they will remain. As for those who did evil, each evil deed will be requited by its equal, and humiliation will cover them. No one will protect them against God, as though their faces covered by veils cut from the darkness of the night. These are the inmates of the fire, and there they shall remain. We will now have our interview with Brother Irfan.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Irfan.
Wa alaikum salam.
Thank you for being here today on Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation. Would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yeah. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. My name is Irfan. I am the OUSA International Student Representative and Co-President of OISA, and it's great to be here on the show.
So you are from Singapore. I wonder if we can talk about, growing up. You also have Indian and Pakistani backgrounds.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I will say, because this is quite an unpopular opinion, but and I don't really agree with it, but people do say this, that I'm not necessarily raised the usual Singaporean way. Also particularly because of the diverse sort of heritage that I come from, as you've mentioned. But I would say that I received a very holistic and balanced upbringing in Singapore. So obviously, education on one side, religion on the other side, and they go very much hand in hand. So where you go to school from for the weekdays, the weekends, we go to the religious classes, the madrasas at the mosque. So it was really balanced. I got a very balanced sort of upbringing in that sense. It was a very disciplined upbringing, as you know, brown parents, very strict, curfews and all those. But I think that sort of shaped me to who I am today, made me sort of more independent. So having come out of the country to New Zealand, and I say this a lot of times, but when I came to New Zealand the first time, I came on my own and sort of felt that, well, I mean, I was definitely in the dark, but I wasn't so clueless to the point that I didn't know exactly what to do, because I've already been equipped with all the skills and particularly the values that my parents taught me that I can bring with me to New Zealand and then sort of go on there. So I think it sort of shaped what I am today. Basically, yeah.
It's good to know you had a balanced upbringing.
Yeah.
Did your parents always grew up in Singapore, or
yes,
did they migrate?
Yes, they were basically. So my grandfather on my father's side, he was from Pondicherry, and then my grandmother's and grandfather's family on my mother's side, they were from Jalandhar, which was pre-independence British India, and moved on to Rawalpindi in Pakistan. So very, very two different countries. But then they came to Singapore somewhere along the lines, and my parents were born in Singapore.
Do you know why they moved to Singapore?
So I know for my maternal grandparents, they moved from Rawalpindi to Singapore because one of my grandfather's brother, he had passed away in Singapore. He had a small sort of healing business. He was doing healing, you know, using traditional methods, curing hemorrhoids with traditional methods, and he had died. So his wife actually told my grandfather to move to Singapore, which was the reason why my maternal grandfather moved. My paternal grandfather simply moved for work purposes, and then he came and was in Singapore way before independence. And yeah, they just lived in Singapore eventually.
So you have a big family in Singapore?
A sizable amount of family in Singapore, Malaysia as well, and Indonesia. Because one of my uncles, he had moved to Indonesia to move his business. And Malaysia, yes, one of my grandmother's sisters, she actually married and moved to Malaysia. So she lived in Perak. And we still have family in Perak. We still have family in Menglembu, Ipoh, which we usually go to. Every 2 or 3 years, we'll do go and build that, you know, connection and, you know, connect with family over there. So it's a sizable size of family in the entire Southeast Asia. Yeah.
So tell me about Singapore. Which part of Singapore did you grow up in?
I was staying in Tampines, 10 minutes drive from the airport. Very congested, I will say. And I only realized this when I came to New Zealand because I don't know. When I was in Singapore, I didn't feel it was too congested. But I remember the first time I came back and then we went out and I felt it was just too congested, you know, with so many people and everything. And I remember being a little bit uncomfortable by that. And then I realized I was in New Zealand for 9 months. So obviously, yeah, it's really warm, all parts of Singapore. And that's why, you know, I usually go back at the end of the year where the weather sort of cools a little bit. It doesn't cool as much, but any cooling is appreciated. And basically that. I did my schooling in a neighborhood school. So, you know, back in Singapore, at least during my time, there was this emphasis, you need to do well, go to a top school, so you'll go far in life and everything. But then Deputy Prime Minister Heng Swee Keat, who's retired already, he was education minister at the time, had the pleasure of working with him, and he used to say that every school is a good school. So there was an emphasis to go to a neighborhood school. And I didn't really do so well in my primary school leaving examination, the PSLE, which everyone hates. So I went to a neighborhood school, did well. And then instead of choosing a top tier college, I decided to go to Tampines Meridian Junior College, which is also about a 5-minute drive from home, which essentially shaped me to what I am today. So I felt that I got a very holistic upbringing in that eastern part of Singapore. Very holistic, very, you know, sort of connected group of people with like-minded ideas, everybody cheering you on to go forward, which is something that I really like.
What did your parents do?
So my father was in the police force. He was in the police force for almost 30 years, left the service. Now he's in the Ministry of Education. And my mother was a nurse. But then when I was born, she left her job. Yeah. So my mother's been out of the job for the last about 30 or 20 something over years, very, very grateful that I had been raised in a home where my mother was there essentially 24/7, and obviously my father, even though he was obviously working busy and all that, but had a very good unique connections with both my mom and my dad. So we are both good memories both with my mom and my dad, and that was really good. Because in my family, I do notice one thing. Between me and my parents, we have a very, very good bond. And I feel that was really important within that one household. Because in a brown family, you can have 10 different relatives. And all 10 different relatives can do 10 different things. But I always found solace in the fact that my parents were in the same house as me and they were the ones that mattered. We built our connections with other family members. We interact with them and all. But obviously, at any point of time when, you know, things go south, sometimes there may be turbulence. I know I have my parents backing me every step of the way. So that was really good.
Do you have siblings?
No. So I initially felt I was lonely because I didn't have a brother or a sister or something. But then after that, as I go on, I realize, you know, it's something that is sort of good, because perhaps if I had a sibling, I wouldn't be able to go overseas and come to New Zealand or something. So life would have been very different, but I'm very happy that I was the only child. Yeah.
Mm. And you mentioned about, you know, going to school during the weekdays and also having madrasa for your Islamic education. Can you tell us more about madrasa?
So in the time when I, just a few years before I actually entered the study, you know, entered education, there was a strong emphasis from the Singapore government that they wanted to sort of, you know, streamline religious education in Singapore, because there was a lot of students who went to mainstream madrasas where they study Islam and their, you know, mainstream subjects on a daily basis from Monday to Fridays. And people were not doing well. Some students were not doing well. And there was a policy that if you don't do well in those systems, you would come out and you will have to go to a government school for that, because obviously the government has a certain level of proficiency. So my parents decided it seemed a little bit volatile. They didn't want to have me sent to a madrasa. It gives us a little bit of moderation. And so they sent me to a government school. The madrasa was called the Alive program. So always learning Islamic values every day, A-L-I-V-E. So that's why they call it Alive program. But they sort of took the syllabus from the mainstream madrasas and they curated it into something which is like a 3-hour session on either a Saturday or a Sunday. And you're doing it for the whole academic year. So there is obviously some breaks in the middle or whatnot, but you are doing it in conjunction with your university studies. And they do a lot of, you know, there's a huge range of things. So we started when I was in primary school, when I first joined, they started with stories of the prophets, you know, stories of, it was more of a storytelling session, literally. And then as you progress further, they go on to the seerah of the prophet, peace be upon him. And then after that, they go in further to religious teachings, what is taught in the Quran, what is taught in the Sunnah, what are the rules, the jurisprudence. So they go in deeper and deeper. And by the time you graduate from, you know, college, in my year it was A-levels, you are expected to already have that proficient level of understanding about the religion. And I felt that sort of shaped me a lot to where I am today, because if I had not gone to Alive, there would be a lot of things that I wouldn't know. And yes, I do have parents. My parents are religious. I do have parents who are very, very practicing Muslim. But I don't think that if that was not reinforced both at home and in the mosque, I don't think I will be able to, you know, sort of survive as a Muslim outside of Singapore in a foreign country, in a Western context, for example. So it is designed in that way to sort of support students so that if a parent says, I don't want to send my son to a madrasa, I want them to go to a government school, they can be sure they can do that with certainty, because obviously the Alive program is a program that has been designed to support the child in every step of the way, from the time they are as young as 7 years old all the way until 18 years old, which meant I did 11 years of Islamic studies alongside 11 years of primary, secondary and, you know, tertiary education, which was really good. Yeah,
it's really good to know that there's that specific system for educating Islam for Singaporeans.
Yeah.
What other experiences do you have as Muslims in Singapore?
So, in Singapore, I must say that in Singapore, we are quite lucky in the sense that there is this sort of act called the Administration of the Muslim Law Act that governs, you know, the practice, the teaching and the learning of Islam in Singapore, which I think it is good. Some people might have, you know, other opinions saying that, you know, they're just trying to police the religion or whatsoever. My opinion is it was good because it sort of gave people that sort of benchmark. And it sort of, I wouldn't say force, but it sort of pushes people to sort of practice Islam and give them certainty that they can do that safely in Singapore, following the, because it is governed by law. As a Singaporean, of course, you know, things have gotten better over the years. Older relatives of mine have said things were very different back in the day, but currently the government does make many provisions for Singaporeans. Friday prayers, for example, males in Singapore get 2 hours off their lunch break, or even school for Friday prayers. There is a law governing that to say that you can't have any religious classes. I mean, you can't have any school classes or whatsoever between the 12 to 2 time slot, because that is usually the prayer times. Recently, because of COVID and the need for social distancing and following that, I mean, obviously more Muslim in Singapore, they've decided to create session 1 and session 2 for Friday prayers, for example. And despite having those two sessions, that 2-hour time slot, even though it's shifted around, it's still mandatory for you to attend. Whether a person attends the Friday prayers or not is not enforced. But I think that sort of safeguard that the government gives, you know, to Muslims in Singapore, I think that's really important. That's really good. Also, the other thing is, and I will say this because I did my national service in the Singapore Civil Defence Force. I was in the firefighter. And in national service as well, they make provisions for prayer arrangements. I have friends in the Singapore Army who say it's different. But in my unit, in the Singapore Civil Defence Force, with a lot of Muslims, 70% of them were Muslims, there were actually provisions for us to do our prayers. So, like, for example, especially for Zuhur and Asr, particularly Zuhur, because it's the midday, right? So lunch break, and then they give us time to do our prayers, and then they continue training, and they make sure training ends just before Asr starts. So it is quite balanced. You know, I think I got a very, very good balance. So I felt like, I think I thank Allah Ta'ala for this, because I think everything fell into place a lot in my life. Because I used to say I wanted to go to the Air Force, to the Army. And then my friends went in and they said, oh, you know, because of the constraints, you're going into the jungle, you are doing training, there is not much provisions for you to do your prayers. And then I got into the Singapore Civil Defence Force, which I was quite disappointed at the start. But then after that, things fell into place. And my parents were like, you know, actually, you're enjoying national service more than others. So I think things really fell into place. And then finally, obviously, on a school context, not really enforced, but I do notice this. Most of the schools in Singapore, all the schools that I've gone to at least, we have Malay teachers, Muslim teachers. So they usually dedicate one room where they just put prayer mats there. And then they'll tell all the Muslim students, this is the place you go to do your prayers. And then we do go and do our prayers there midway through the day or something. Obviously, if it's a class time, then wait for the class to finish, get the latest break and do your prayers. But I think it's really, the government encourages us to practice our religion and reassures us it's safe to do it in Singapore, which was really good. Yeah,
it's good to know there are systems in place. But before we talk more, I wonder if you can give us a bit of insight into how many Muslims are there in Singapore and also social, just for the listeners.
I think 10 to 20% of the population are Malays and about 95, 96% of Malays are Muslims. And I think we have about a 15, 20% Muslim population. And it's growing. It's growing because the government announces a new package to expand the number of mosques, increase the number of mosques, increase the capacity every year. And every year it's not enough. So they still have to increase. And I think we have a very good amount of Muslims in the country to support the practice, the teaching, and obviously the proliferation of Islam in Singapore, which I will just bring one new point in before we move, where the government brought in the mosque building fund. So every Muslim in Singapore will automatically be opting to pay a fee of about $30, $35 every month from their salary to the mosque building fund. And the government matches it on a dollar for dollar thing. So that goes into a pot, which goes to renovate your mosques, to clean the mosques, to build new mosques, you know, and also to support the needy in Singapore. So if you are earning more, you are paying more. If you are earning less, you are paying less. But everybody has to pay something.
Every Muslim.
Every Muslim has to pay something. I mean, at this point, the government did make a change in AMLA just a few years back. And they said that if you don't want to contribute, you can opt out of it. But even though that has come in, the opt-out requests are really low to negligible. People still contribute to it. So it signals that we are still very harmonious, which is good to know. Yeah.
And it's good to know there is a way to support the community. And the government has created systems in place for Singaporean Muslims.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was really important, which was good.
Let's talk about your education pathway. So you did mention high school in Singapore, and you also went into civil service. But tell us how, the pathway from post-high school to before you came to New Zealand.
So obviously I took A-levels. And after my A-levels, I went into national service. So that was literally a two-year break.
So for national service, is that something you have to do in Singapore?
Every Singaporean male above the age of 18 or across the age of 18 will have to do 2 years of national service unless a deferment is allowed or unless a severe medical complication which allows you to be exempted. But, I was in the vast majority of people that had to do my national service for 2 years. Literally no study at that point of time. Good break. I was in the officer cadet course. I came out with an injury, so which was a blessing in disguise eventually, because I broke my leg and then they said, but I sort of commissioned and then they said, you broke your leg, so you can't really go into the front lines. So they put me in admin. So I was in the headquarters. I was a personal assistant to the deputy commissioner of the Singapore Civil Defence Force. And then I was basically assigned to desk job and obviously assisting the deputy commissioner, which was a high-ranking bureaucrat in the Singapore government. And over there, I learned about government administrations. I learned about, how a system is being run. How do you manage crises? Using my skills, obviously as a trained firefighter, but now using my skills to sort of support the specialist firefighters to do their job. And then I obviously extrapolate that to what I would do as, outside of the firefighting sphere, basically. So it's a very holistic skill building, I will call it. You're building your skills, leadership skills, communication skills, things that you get to take away from when you leave the force. So that was for 2 years. And then after that 2 years, 2 days after I finished my national service, I was out of Singapore. So then, very eager to leave the country. But before that, actually, for about 8 months, I enrolled in the Foundation Studies Certificate at the PALC Pathway and Language Centre. It was COVID years, so I was able to do that online.
From Singapore?
From Singapore, so I had to get an exemption from the force, but they gave it to me. I said I was going to be studying. I have to do this online. Unless you guys don't approve this, then I'll have to go there and I have to do an extra year. And my superiors were saying, you know, it's completely fine. Just go ahead and do your studies. But I was doing my studies alongside my national service for the last 8 months of my service, which I felt it was quite eye-opening, quite good. I was quite happy about it. And I think that was really good. It was slightly hectic at times, obviously, when, you know, you are close to the end of the month and then people are preparing for ministerial meetings and, you know, you are getting people shouting from ministry levels and all that. But I felt it built my tenacity, built my resilience. I would say my mental health was strongest when I was in national service. And I feel that if there's one downside is having left the force, mental health has slightly gone down. But my mental health was really good during national service.
This is really good insight to the compulsory civil service that Singaporeans have to do. Was that the case for you, that you had any reservations about it before you started?
I was scared because we hear the horror stories of people going into national service and then obviously training accidents, people die, and then very, very strenuous training hours, and everybody is very scared because apparently, you know, food is bad in national service. So you get the horror stories. And obviously where I went, Singapore Civil Defence Force is just right beside the graves. So people will try to scare you and be like, you know, this and that. But when I came in, I realised it wasn't as bad as what people think, you know. Like, you don't, unless there's a training accident or something, you're not going to die just by going into national service. So I think it was a surprise. I will say it was a surprise because I was worried. I was scared. I didn't want to do national service initially. But when I came in, I saw, I mean, they were very supportive. I mean, our seniors, our sergeants, our officers, they sort of knew that these people, young little kids coming in, and obviously everybody's going to be scared because they made a movie about it, Our Boys to Men, where they dramatized the whole thing and made it like it's really bad or whatsoever. But then after that, when you go in, they sort of ease you into it. And obviously they push you, they discipline you, but they're not going to start disciplining you from day one. It's a gradual process. So I was pleasantly surprised. And I feel my national service story is quite boring because, I mean, my peers will definitely have more things to say going into the jungles and all those things. But I think it was a unique experience for me, which I feel I had it quite easy.
You broke your leg, though.
Yes, that was at the end of the training. And then it was after that, it was, what, 1.5 years worth of desk work, which was pretty boring. But I felt I had it quite easy. Not during the training days, of course, but after that, because of my leg. And also, obviously, the leg issue was essentially because I sort of strained it, overdid it. And one of the officers was just like pushing. So they pushed it a little bit too much. And then I obviously fractured my leg. But then apart from that one isolated incident, I think it was really, really unique. And also not just unique because of the training, but also because of the camaraderie you build with people. Because we stay in a bunk of 20 different people. And so during admin time, when there's no television, we're just sitting down there, we polish our shoes, we're talking to each other. You learn about people's different lives, you know. I come from a different background. And you see the different kinds of lives of people in Singapore. You meet people you never meet in your life. And then you get to understand this is, you know, this is how people are, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think it was really eye-opening as well, which is something I really appreciated, yeah.
So after your online foundation studies, you came to Otago. So why did you choose New Zealand to do your undergrad?
So I had two options. I had the UK and I had New Zealand. And I had friends who had gone to the UK and told me not to go there. They said, don't come here. At the point of time, it was the UK's sort of decline under the Liz Truss era and all those issues were happening. So a lot of people were like, don't come here. You know, the UK is in a very bad shape. So you wouldn't want to start your university education somewhere where it's a really, really bad shape. So what I decided, okay, what's the other option? Had a friend who came here, and he said he was in Wellington. He said, you know, you should go to Otago because it's very good in their sciences. It's also closer to home. You know, you can just drive up to Christchurch, and then you can fly from Christchurch. And it's way closer, essentially.
And you wanted to do science?
And I wanted to do health science, also because parents were pressuring. So, but in both cases, and then me and my parents, we made the decision to come back to Singapore. To come to New Zealand, so I could come back to Singapore every year, which I still do until now. And that's the distance was basically the reason why I chose to come to Dunedin. And then when I came here, I felt that it was really, really good. I was telling my experience to my friends back home when I went back, and they were like, you know, you're quite lucky. You got a good sort of education. You got a good experience in New Zealand. Because some of them who go overseas, they go for exchange programs to Norway, to the UK, to other countries. And they found it to be not as, you know, so not as good as, you know, the experience that I had. So I think I might have made the jackpot decision or something to come here. Yeah.
So you're in your final semester of your Bachelor of Health Sciences. Tell me about that.
Yes. I think it has been quite a journey. From health science first year, I went into biomedical sciences because I wanted to, I thought, you know, biomedical sciences would be something that I really liked. But then after that, after 6 months, I discovered the heavy content was very similar to medicine, which is not something that I do. I prefer to go more macro. And then I sort of discovered that what I wanted to do was not really become a doctor or become a researcher, but more to sort of support people in the, you know, sort of support the people who make the health system work. So that means supporting healthcare professionals such as the doctors, the nurses, allied health providers, to be able to support our community in providing world-class healthcare. And then I realized policy analysis is what I do best. You know, combining my skills in student leadership, administration, and governance, and obviously with the skills in public health, I felt that I would want to go into a public health perspective, get the analysis perspective point in hand, because over there you get to make more macro decisions and you can hopefully make decisions that, you know, will be able to sort of improve the healthcare system, make the system work for everybody, and obviously support the healthcare, support the doctors. And I found that was more fulfilling because I felt I couldn't micromanage or sort of micro, you know, coordinate. I'm more good with macro coordination. So I said, if I can't treat a single patient, why not I support a group of doctors to treat an entire community of patients or to provide medical care to an entire community of patients? And then at least these people will get world-class medical that we need. So that was basically the reason why I chose to go into public health. And then obviously now, towards the end of it, I'm looking into postgrad. I'm most probably going to do a master's in public health at some point. But I'm going to take a bit of a break first. I'm going to take a 6 month break. I've told my parents I'm going to take a 6 month break because it's been quite the journey.
Mm.
Yeah.
And something we haven't really mentioned here is on top of studying, you've also been involved in student advocacy.
Yes.
Specifically in the New Zealand International Students Association as the president last year. And this year, you're the OUSA International Representative.
Yep.
So how has that been for you going into advocacy?
I joined advocacy in my first year as the residential rep of the Otago International Students Association. I was just a member of OISA, and then I would go on to head that organization alongside Ibuki as co-president. And then at the point of time was also public relations officer of NZISA, and then became NZISA president. And then I came back to OISA as co-president this year and international rep. So I feel, when I came to New Zealand, I felt that I had a very, very good sort of welcome into the country. I felt I had a connection to the country, the people here, the vibes. So I decided, you know, why not? I should probably do something. And if I got this, you know, opportunity, I was able to be welcomed so much into this country. And it's such a welcoming place. perhaps we need to raise some awareness to our international students that New Zealand is the country to be. And I had discovered since that time that a lot of people were planning to get their degree from New Zealand and, you know, head off to Australia or the UK, which they consider greener pastures. But I felt that I received a lot of opportunity in this country. I got the chance to come on your show, come on Political Pulse after that, create a radio show, contribute to the community. And I felt that if I was able to do all this, I should probably try and pay it forward and maybe, you know, open some avenues for international students to come and contribute. And so I felt OISA was the first way to do this. And OISA was sort of rebuilding after COVID because we were trying to also work with the international office to increase the international student numbers. But increasing the numbers is one thing. Providing the support that the student needs is completely, you know, a completely new ball game. So we work very closely with the international office to do that. Our events, in my first time as OISA co-president, was more on events. And then when I went to NZISA, I was more involved with the advocacy and the planning. So I was sitting on the government committees among the Ministry of Health, Te Whatu Ora. Also attended some government events such as the Eid celebration in Parliament for 2 years, represented NZISA in those. And obviously in those things built my connections with members of government and the diplomatic corps. And obviously I did visit the high commissions, a couple of them, to raise awareness that NZISA exists, is there for our international student community. And if there is any form of intervention that our international student need, we will be happy to do that. Also, one key thing that I learned from NZISA, and the main thing that I was doing in NZISA, was more of advocacy. So there were a lot of international students who got their post-study work visa, which was shorter than what they expected. So obviously clarifying the rules around that and then getting those information to students was very important. And finally, of course, there were students who, you know, because of inaccurate information that they received from their education providers, you know, they were served with deportation notice. The visa was ending. So obviously writing to the government to, you know, request for ministerial intervention, which you can normally only get if you have already built an understanding and a connection with, you know, the government departments. But we managed to do that. Obviously, crisis management, but you know, I've learned a lot in that, so I was really good with that. Now coming into OUSA, I feel it's more of a local. It has come back locally, so I started locally, went national, and now I'm back locally. On a local perspective, it's more about how you make Dunedin and the University of Otago a place that people are very, very happy to be in campus, you know, to interact, to meet around. Because there's a lot of campus around the world. I talk to friends who say that we only go to campus on an as-needed basis. They don't normally go there. But I think we like it in Otago because in Otago, you can just go anywhere in the university and there's something for everyone everywhere. Lending my voice to the university's plannings, I wasn't in the conversation at that time because I had something else on. But for instance, the campus master plan that the university is working on, also certain policies around, you know, how we engage our student community. I was recently in a video to raise awareness about the events that the university is having and also some of the festivities that the students would, you know, sort of celebrate, like the St. Patrick's Day, which I normally don't participate in this kind of events. But, you know, obviously lending the international student perspective to the conversation is something that is very important and also sort of gives an equity perspective to it. Because, you know, international students are also considered one of the equity groups, at least by advocates around the country. So it is a very, very broad range of things that I have been working on. And I feel that, you know, coming back locally this year, hopefully in the final year of advocacy that I do, I think we can bring all those skills in and sort of make a very, very good international student experience for many years to come.
So you've been very involved with the international student space.
Yeah.
Tell us about your experience with the Muslim community.
So Well, I mean, weekly Friday prayers, I do go very much. And among the Muslim community in Dunedin, so my closest circle of friends, I will say, are Muslims. I will confess, I'm only much more involved with Musa this year since we started working on the Eid celebrations at the dental school, and also being involved with the wider conversation with Musa about how, you know, providing them a sort of the support and the advisory perspective about how they can sort of rejuvenate and train up their execs to be able to, you know, deliver on the key objectives. I think that is something that I've started to work with alongside our welfare and equity representative, Rihanna. We've worked on a, you know, sort of a plan to try and engage Musa and understand how we can better support the execs to support the Muslim community in general. Obviously, I will say, having come to New Zealand, the first time I came to New Zealand, I felt the sort of, you know, the practice of Islam, I would say, is much more different. Not much more, but slightly different compared to what we would do in Singapore. There's certain things that are pretty different, but I adjusted very quickly and very easily to that. So I felt it was good. And of course, every year, you know, we look forward to Ramadan because we get to break fast together among students. Previously, it was the community for the whole month, but then I think somewhere along the line, they changed it. So weekdays, students get to break fast in the mosque only, and in weekends, the community comes together. I have never broken fast in a mosque when I was in Singapore. And that was because I felt, and now I realize this, that I was actually very, very lucky because I had someone at home, my mother, who would actually cook, and we will get to breakfast as a family at home. But when I came here, then I realized, you know, that, you know, sometimes there are people who will come from very far, like international students ourselves. We don't have families in this country. So we try to find and make do. So we come to, you know, the mosque, we meet other international students. It sort of, you know, enhances our Ramadan experience somehow. Not the same as home, but still. And then when I came back to Singapore, I told my parents, you know, the mosque is this. And my dad was like, yeah, you think in Singapore we don't have this. We don't have this because you don't see it, because you don't go to the mosque and break your fast. We are breaking fast as a family back home. So I think it's very eye-opening, you know, interacting, seeing how the Islam is practiced in New Zealand, seeing how the Muslim community works together in New Zealand, especially in Dunedin. I think that was really, really, you know, good to see. Yeah.
What a great reflection of your Muslim experience in Dunedin. You've also been involved in like student associations like OMSA. Can you tell us about your involvement with like the Pakistani community or other community groups?
Yeah, I was very involved with the Pakistan Association of Otago, now the Pakistani Community of Otago, when I was, it was in 2024, and then sort of took a bit of a hiatus to focus on NZISA, and obviously last year as well, because I was NZISA president. So I think that was, you know, I participated with the Pakistani community at the time, sort of because they were looking for a student lead. I felt it really very much tied in, sort of built some skills as well, networking, lending the voice to, you know, of students, basically, to the association. And this year, I sort of, you know, with the formation of the Pakistani community of Otago, which I very much support, you know, I sort of came back. I can't really remember how I came back, but I did. Came back, got involved, helping them out with the Eid celebrations alongside my very good friend, Ian. So we were the two youths there in the organizing committee. We sort of helped out and planned that event. We were more involved in the technical side of it. And I wouldn't say I'm that involved with the Pakistani community of Otago at this point, but yeah, whenever they do need some sort of a perspective or a point of view that they feel that I'm of help, I always sort of try and help out. Yeah.
What needed. About the Indian Student Association? You were part of a play.
Yes, I was treasurer of ISA last year and decided that the job was so good that I decided to do another year. So I was treasurer for 2 years. I'm still the ISA treasurer this year. I was in the play last year. I played the role of a father, but, you know, we don't talk about that on air. But the Indian Students Association was more of a, you know, student advocacy and, you know, sort of a place where we sort of can create events for our Indian student community. I was also on the lookout for, you know, are there any Muslim students that might find it hard to sort of gel within, you know, the Indian Students Association? Because obviously our association, I think ISA itself, it has a lot of social events. So obviously having a Muslim in exec sort of can try and, you know, see and weigh the ways. I mean, you know, sort of try and... If there are Muslim students basically in the association and they might seem to be not so comfortable by the many social events, at least with a Muslim or two in the committee, we sort of can slot in some non-social events or maybe those that does not require drinking or something. So at least the Muslims can get involved. And quiz night has become a very regular thing for ISA. They've had an annual quiz night, movie nights. These are all sober events. Trying to get more inclusivity among the community itself. So that was really good. For OMSA, because I remembered OMSA, for OMSA, I'm more involved there as a member of the community. So I've not been in the most, I've not been in our OMSA exec. I've been mostly attending the events because I very much appreciate the Malaysian culture, because I feel it's very synonymous with who I am as a person. Open secret, you know this. I always prefer road trips in Malaysia. Love the country, love the vibes, love the food. And only last year, I mean, Sofia invited me to join the Bersatu Games committee. So I was involved in that. Helped out on the welfare aspect of it. So we arranged some care packs for our players. Got some care packs from Dosa, etc., which had a samosa, you know, some bread or something, just to fuel the participants. And then this year I'm getting involved with OMSA again as the sound and lighting manager for the Malam Malaysia that's coming, which I feel it's going to be very exciting. Sort of decided to help them out with that because they're restarting Malam Malaysia after a very long time. And I had already had experience in ISA with show and with managing sound and lighting. So helping them out in that aspect as well.
So you've been very involved with so many things while you're studying. I wonder if we can talk about Palestine. So how much did you know about the Palestinian issue before the recent events?
I think it has been, I think the whole conflict has been happening for a very long, long time, you know. Ever since I was in Singapore, I mean, this issue does crop up, whether in the religious classes, whether in schools as well, because in Singapore schools, we usually dedicate an hour a week called citizenship, character and citizenship education, which is sort of, you know, current affairs, but also how do you approach these issues as a Singaporean, as a citizen living outside the zones. So I sort of knew, I mean, every year or two, there will always be those conflicts, you know, some things erupt and then people get killed. So I was quite aware of the incident, but I will say that obviously the whole situation blew up on October the 7th and the aftermath of it, which has continued until today, which is absolutely devastating. So yes, I knew that this Israel-Palestine issue has been there for a very long time, since at least 1948, you know, since the establishment. But obviously my awareness of the issue has obviously, you know, sort of enhanced, particularly in recent few years. And obviously in the past few weeks, really, with this war that did not actually need to happen, but yeah.
How do you keep yourself informed with the updates about the war?
Yeah, so I mean, I have Guardian on my phone, the Guardian UK on my phone. I have RNZ. I read a New Zealand Herald. I'm still keeping abreast with news back home in Singapore, The Star and The Straits Time in Singapore. So I try and read a wide range of things, you know, just to get a more balanced issue. At home here, I'm quite fortunate because my television on the free-to-air has Al Jazeera. So there's a lot of documentaries. So I do watch those documentaries And even though my parents will be like, don't watch them, you know, it can be very depressing. But I think it's really good to just understand how the whole situation is and whatsoever. There's a lot of fake news going around as well. So it's really important to verify the news, which is why I read three different news sites, for example, for that one article, just to see what's the balance of things there. Yeah.
And with the recent events around the war on Iran, what are your views around that?
Of course, I think my sympathies go out to all the families whose lives have been lost in this senseless war, whether it's in the GCC, in the Middle East, or even in Iran. And having said that, I also send my solidarity to the people of Palestine for, you know, what has happened for a long, long time. Not just happened in the last 2 years, it's been happening for such a long time. I do hope to see the situation end. I mean, they usually say it's a ceasefire, but it's not normally a ceasefire eventually. But obviously sending my solidarity and prayers and dua to everyone whose lives have been lost. I feel the Iran-US conflict did not have to happen, essentially. And let's just hope that, you know, there's lasting peace in the Middle East region. Because I feel that, and it does demoralize a lot of my friends, at least, that I know, who say that every other year or every 3 or 4 years, there's always somebody who's going to say something or something will happen. It sort of demoralizes this, the children, the young, the youth, because the youth are hoping for a promising future. So when you have this kind of conflicts, it becomes very, very bleak. And it does demoralize a lot of people. And let's just hope that, you know, the leaders involved will sort of put differences to one side, think of the greater good of humanity, and sort of work for the common goal of protecting mankind, really. Mm. Yeah.
We've learned a lot about you today. And just wrapping up the interview, I wonder if you can share any advice you have for the Muslim students at Otago?
I think my advice for the Muslim students in Otago would be, obviously, if they were to come from a different country or from a different city, make sure you hold your family values really, really close to you. Because sometimes, and this is something that I will say, it's not really my advice, it's more of my father's advice, but temptation is there and temptation will always be there. So, and obviously, if you're coming into a new city, family might be at home, family is not with you. But Allah Ta'ala is still up there watching, you know. So yeah, temptation is always going to be there. People are going to tell you to do things. Sometimes these things might be against your values or whatsoever. But I feel like if you stick to your own family values, I think that will be the way that guides you forward. And one of my religious teachers in Singapore, which I have learned from him for the last 5 years of my religious education, and I continue to call him very regularly, he says one thing to the Muslims, to me as a Muslim, he said, never leave your prayers. You know, your five prayers, just don't leave it. Because if you don't, because this five is a protection for you. And I feel it's not just a protection, it's also like a mental health reset for me. So if you don't, if you miss any one of this, then that protection barrier is sort of broken. So it's easier for you to fall into any form of temptation or whatsoever. So these are the two pieces of advice. Really hold your family values really well close to you. That is a non-negotiable at all, no matter what people say, never mind or whatever. And obviously the five-time prayer is very, very important. And obviously surround yourself with people in events that make you comfortable, get an awareness of the community. The Ramadan was always a very good time. I'm also trying to work with Musa to try and see how we can make more events outside of Ramadan and Eid so they can better engage the Muslim community. But for now, obviously, with Ramadan, it's very, very good to see a lot of Muslim students coming to the mosques to break their fast, going for the Eid event to celebrate. We had a huge turnout, the biggest turnout this time. So I hope this thing continues. And aside from that, I mean, outside of the Muslim space, Muslim students can get involved in Dunedin, in the University of Otago. I'm a Muslim. I've gone into OUSA. Rihanna is Muslim. She's gone into OUSA. So there's no limits to what you can achieve in this city and this country. Yeah. So just seize every opportunity.
That's beautiful, Irfan. Thank you so much for being here today. All the best for your final semester of university. And inshallah, talk to you soon.
Inshallah. Thank you. Assalamualaikum.
Thank you, Brother Irfan. Now we listen to an Islamic song by Bashiruddin entitled Alhamdulillah, All Praise to You.
Alhamdulillah, all praise to you. In every blessing, every day anew. Alhamdulillah, my heart will sing. Thank you, Allah, for everything. In the golden dawn, my heart awakes. Thankful for the breath. Spirit takes soft light upon the silent ancient earth. Alhamdulillah for every moment of work. The skies embrace the song of gentle rain. Mercy descends and hope blooms again. Alhamdulillah.
That is the end of our program today. Thank you for your time. Special thank you to ORFM for facilitating the production of this program. I should add that the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of Otago Muslim Chaplaincy as such. If you have any questions, please email muslimchaplaincy@otago.ac.nz. We hope to see you next time. Inshallah, God willing. Assalamualaikum.
You've been listening to Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at OARFM Dunedin.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.